It's a bird.
It's a plane.
No, wait. It's just Novak flying on the ground again?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Hold On to Your Racket, the podcast for Gen Z tennis fans. We're your hosts, Shravya.
And Josefina.
Josefina and I are so excited to be creating this podcast and sharing our love for tennis with you all.
Shravya and I are a college and high school gal duo and two tennis fanatics united together by our on-the-court and off-the-court companionship.
And we're the female Gen Z voices in modern-day tennis you've been looking for, so we hope you enjoy this episode and stay tuned for more.
Hello, and well, we're back with another Hold On to Your Racket episode. And lately, we've definitely done some exciting stuff, but for now, we're going to focus on something else, and then we're going to get to that. But yeah. It's not been too long since we had an episode, but it is our 101st episode. This is a new, like, century, if you want to call it that, of Hold On to Your Racket, which is pretty cool. So, I don't know. Maybe, hopefully, we live up to the name.
Yes, we're kicking into summer, and we have, obviously, the summer season of tennis ahead of us, but first, we're going to wrap up Wimbledon this episode. Definitely a lot of interesting headlines throughout the tournament, and the one that we would like to focus on is Nick Kyrgios facing charges of assault. So, since the beginning of the grass season, really, Kyrgios was in the spotlight. He had a pretty good season. He had a really dramatic match versus Tsitsipas in that third round, which I don't even want to bother discussing because it was a very hot topic of conversation when it was happening. But that was just so much immaturity from both of them in that one. And then obviously Nick reached the Wimbledon finals. And this was all amidst the allegations, which came sort of right before his quarter.
Yeah. So, if you don't remember Chiara Passari, his ex-girlfriend, we definitely spoke about this before, but this is the first time that she's actually taken it to court. So this is now becoming a legal process more than just accusations that seemingly floated around the internet and then people forgot about them. But I'm just going to quickly recap how we found out about this initially. So there was these Instagram story posts that she did that she spoke about emotional abuse from him. So this included violent or manipulative text messages, stories of him leaving her alone late at night without her phone or wallet in New York City while he went to go clubbing with his ex. This includes cheating and seemingly toxic behavior on both ends, but it was really on her side that she got down to the details and spoke about, like, how he was harming her when they were in a relationship together. And they dated from July 2020 to October of 2021. And then this kind of, like, culminated in the huge incident at the Adelaide Hotel where the police even ended up showing up.
Yeah, and that was right after Laver Cup. We kind of talked about that, how they, after coming back from Laver Cup, they had to quarantine, and then they had a really big fight at that hotel, and police, as you said, had to end up showing up, and we heard about that in the news. And that night, Chiara was posting all this stuff on her stories about Nick cheating. She even posted a photo of him sleeping in bed with someone, and captioned the photo, "That girl naked in bed with him isn't me, by the way. Hope that clears it up." And then now, so obviously all this is talks about emotional abuse, like a really kind of not safe environment, it seems like. And these charges are of assault, so implying that things did get physical, aside from all the evident emotional abuse. So Kyrgios is scheduled to come to court on August 2nd for, quote, one charge of common assault following an incident in December 2021. So this is after this, a couple months after the Adelaide incident. So kind of unclear about when exactly their relationship officially ended, but this is seemingly pointing to one specific incident. But what we're trying to show with the backstory here is that Kiara was definitely speaking out about some fishy and definitely red flag behavior in the months leading up to that.
Yeah. And then, of course, people, since Kyrgios, like we said, has been in the spotlight a lot lately, and that has to do with his tennis performance. Like, yeah, he was just in the Wimbledon final today, and people are trashing Kiara for the fact that, oh, of course you had to release it when he's at his biggest, when he's at his best. Like, that just makes sense. Of course you would do that, because you're angry and spiteful. But it just, that doesn't even check out, because, like, since when has it taken a week to call someone into court, let alone for the court to release that news? Like, no. Like, there's no way she could have known that he was going to make it to the final. And it just wasn't calculated that way. And no one should be assuming that it is calculated, because you're just undermining the victim that way.
Yeah, like, in my opinion, like, I've heard a lot of, like, innocent until proven guilty. But, like, for me, like, defending Nick, like, you choosing not to believe Kiara is in no way, like, less valid than me being, like, I choose to support the victim. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like one is more, I'm not phrasing this correctly. But people kind of act like supporting the victim is unfounded or, like, not based in any sort of actual legitimacy, and more so just that people do it because they think it's the morally sound thing to do, and then people respond with, but hey, innocent until proven guilty. But I really just think that believing the victim is important, especially when you have all this lead up to it. And if I choose that's how I choose to believe her in this situation, because of not only, like, the backstory and everything that she's provided over the past couple of years, but because I don't think that that is in any way less morally sound than abiding by the innocent until proven guilty doctrine. I don't really see a difference.
I don't understand it, because the whole point is that, like, systematically, like, legally, of course, it's innocent until proven guilty. That's just the procedure. Of course. The fact is that since it is that way systematically, it's up to people that have seen what she has to say that are apart from the governmental or legal system to believe her and support her. Because we can't make any court decisions for anyone. So it's up to us to just support her as, I mean, in our case, fellow women, I guess.
Right, or fellow people, even. Like, if I choose to support Kiara, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing binding me to be, as you said, by the innocent until proven guilty dogma if I'm not one of the people making that decision, right? Like, I have the freedom to choose who I want to support, and for me, like, this whole notion that victims or, like, people who bring forth these allegations are most of the time doing it just for attention or whatever is factually inaccurate.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you look at the, I obviously don't know the exact statistics, but why would someone want to falsely accuse someone in this big of a light, you know, knowing what the consequences would be? I don't really understand.
Yeah. And, like, another thing I don't understand regarding stigma in these situations, like, when you say you're supporting the victim, people that are, for example, in this case, fans of Kyrgios, they're like, you're just saying that because you don't like Nick and you've never liked Nick. It has nothing to do with that. Yeah. It has absolutely nothing to do with that, and it shouldn't be attached either way. Like, if our support is with Kiara, that's just how it is. The way I said it is how it is.
Yeah, I think also after the whole Amber Heard, Johnny Depp thing, I very loosely followed that. But I think the way that people sort of made Amber out to be this hysterical liar or, like, crazy woman or, like, completely off the rails was really damaging to a lot of victims out there who come forth against powerful men. I'm not talking about, like, the results of the Heard Depp trial at all. I'm just talking about the way that people really jumped on the opportunity to characterize her in a particular way and use that as a sort of poster for all women, like, women in general coming out against powerful men or, like, celebrities, which I thought was quite damaging, and a trope that we even saw when Olya Sharapova came out with her allegations. So I think that this notion always comes up when you see these sorts of allegations brought forth. So it's definitely not anything new, but something certainly worth talking about. And I mean, we always talked about how with these Instagram story posts, it seemed like a lot of toxicity overall, but at the root of it, it really did seem like there was, like, you can, it's hard to see him, like, so aggressive on court and with that behavior, and then seeing all of this also. I don't know, I just, it definitely seemed like a very emotionally abusive relationship.
Yeah, and, like, this time, Kiara, she didn't wait to reach out to the ATP to see if they would put him on trial or whatever. She went straight to her government, which was the Canberra court, right? Yeah. So, again, we know and remember that the ACP has a very ugly track record regarding abuse, because we've seen, like, four cases now in the past year, 2 years, year and a half, probably, and it's just, like, what's going on here that they're just allowing
this? Yeah, what's up with that domestic violence policy? Like, what happened to that?
Yeah, because now the worst thing that could possibly happen is that this becomes a trend. Mm-hmm. Like, how can something this horrible become a trend throughout an entire sports organization?
Yeah, it's clearly just looks like they turn a blind eye to these sorts of allegations and incidents. Yeah.
But the fact is that this happens, and I mean, maybe the reason that more we've seen, like, kind of a concentration of women come forward is because the other ones are, like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Like, she may have felt compelled when she saw Olya come out after that whole thing. In fact, actually, she posted during kind of that phase where she was really posting a lot of those Instagram stories. She's since made her account private, but back then she had, like, a whole, like, ask me a question thing on her Instagram story, and at once she said that Nick Kyrgios has a lot in common with Zverev, and someone asked her, what do you mean by that? And she said, I'm not believing or believing any of the speculations against Zverev, but all I'm saying is if those speculations and reports were true about him, then his behavior is very similar to Nick's. That's what they have in common. So Nick Kyrgios has not really commented on the allegations himself whenever asked by reporters outright. Obviously, like, it's probably, like, a legal advice as well. But it didn't seem to bother him on the tennis court, really. Maybe,
yeah,
like,
he's living his best life, which is the worst part. Mm-hmm. Like, in the midst of these, you know what, if you want to spin it this way, like, how people are saying that she only released this information because he's into the Wimbledon final, maybe it's knowing that this was coming out that gave him the fire to get there. I don't know. The same pattern happened with Zverev. It was, like, all of a sudden when Olya came out with her allegations, he started doing phenomenally on the court, which sucked. It was just horrible karma. But, I mean, the fact that they are on court and thriving is the issue. Like, that's the main issue here.
Yeah, and it made it really difficult to watch. His behavior already was making it difficult for me to watch any of the men's tournaments this grass season, because I just didn't want to see him play, and the tennis media is obsessed with him because people say he's, like, he's good for tennis and, like, entertaining. I find his behavior on court in general to be absolutely disgusting. He spit on a fan. He yells at chair umpires and match officials. He's reckless in general. I think it's really harmful and just, like, double standard behavior. Like, you see it branded as, like, entertaining and passionate when it's, like, men doing it, but if, like, a female player, like, either starts crying or, like, gets angry or gets revved up or whatever on court, that's seen as, like, hysterical. So in his behavior already was making it difficult for me to watch the men's tournaments because I just didn't care and they wouldn't stop talking about him. But once these allegations came out, it was like, and people continued to hype him up, and even a lot of male tennis journalists continuing to sort of bat an eye. Yeah. Not bat an eye. It was really awful. Like, people were really calling out Ben Rothenberg because of how he was, like, really not talking much about these Kyrgios allegations and kept complimenting his tennis.
Really? And out of all people?
Out of all, after all, he did and promoted that Olya story to now just sort of not care about this, it kind of just shows that, like, you're not a real supporter of victims if you don't care about all of the people who come forward. Like, you can't pick and choose
based on which players you
like and don't like, you know? Exactly.
I just don't understand. Like, the thing is that with this personality that Nick has built on court, he's created this kind of environment that makes any, like, sort of that, what you were saying, what would have been hysterical on the women's side, like, he makes it seem okay. And somehow this has been kind of looped into that, you know? So it's all kind of this one big Nick Kyrgios bubble of, oh, if he's being reckless, it's fine, because that's just how he is. That's how he plays, and that's how he plays on and off court now that we've seen. So it's totally chill. It's just Kyrgios being Kyrgios.
And I hate this whole thing about how he's good for tennis because he brings this attention. No. We've seen, like, the great parallel, I think, to draw is Carlos Alcaraz, for example, or Emma Raducanu and Leila Fernandez at the U.S. Open. Like, people who are entertaining players, if I'm talking about the men's side, Carlos Alcaraz, people who are entertaining players who brought in attention beyond the tennis world, but have basic sportsmanship. You know, I hated seeing people continue to post about Nick Kyrgios even when this news had come out, because a lot of what I was seeing was, like, people saying things like, oh, all of these guys do this to their girlfriends, or the girlfriend always comes out and says something. I heard someone say that, or people not even knowing about it in the first place because the tennis media doesn't want to talk about it. It's quite frustrating to see these things on the ATP. As you said, this is the fourth now. It's shameful. I don't really know what else to say, because it's like, who's going to do the actual job of properly bringing these sorts of issues up when you're commentating matches, when you're reporting on players, when you're talking about all that? Because it is so much more than just how they perform on court and how much attention they draw in.
Yeah, I feel like it's just tennis media in general. It shows how artificial it's been lately on the men's side. It's kind of, the idea is that they've built up this person so much, like, especially in Kyrgios's case, like, they've built him up to be that person with that personality on court, and they can't afford to break him down, you know?
Yeah. All that being said, I think we probably just want to extend our support to Kiara from what we've seen, and what we always believe is the right thing to do is to support victims, because they have taken the brave step to come forward and share their story and you know, go through that big task.
Turmoil,
because that's scary to do, to come out against some, like, especially someone so high profile. So I think people need to take a moment to realize that this is not something easy for these women to do, or victims in general to do, right? Like, it takes a lot of strength to be able to do that, and it really just doesn't make sense in my mind why someone would go through all that.
Just because. It. Yeah, I agree. So, like I promised earlier in the episode, we are now going to talk about a little exciting experience that we've had very recently, as in yesterday. As in, I still very much feel the sunburn on my back. It is so bad. I'm so paranoid about it.
But I never get sunburn, and even today, like, I took a hot shower this morning, and I felt a little, like, tingle on my back, like, a burnt little tingle, and I was like, wow, this, like, never happens to me. It was really hot yesterday, and this is because we were at this wonderful event called The Hill in New York. It was a Wimbledon-hosted event in Brooklyn, right by the pier, so you could, like, it was right on the, if you're familiar with New York geography, right on the East River, and you could basically overlooking the Manhattan skyline. It was beautiful. And kind of at Brooklyn Bridge Park, they had set up, again, this was organized all by Wimbledon, and this was all free. We sort of entered a lottery, and, you know, I put in 3 emails. I got tickets for the women's singles final. They basically recreated Henman Hill in New York City. Had a huge screen showing, they had 3 days, so they did Friday, so the men's semis, they did Saturday, which is when we went to the, when we got tickets and when we went to the women's final, and today, which they did the men's final, they also showed the doubles, and basically they had set up, like, these really pretty arches, like a little kind of walk-through down the road into the park of kind of the brief history of Wimbledon. And then they had, like, stewards there and all the uniforms and stuff. Obviously, like, people had set up picnic blankets and things like that on the grass to replicate the hill, to watch the match on the big screen. They had Wimbledon cocktails, Wimbledon sandwiches, scones, strawberries and cream, lots of areas for photo ops. And it was just really scenic and I think an awesome experience. They kind of, the way they organized it was you could do a lottery ticket or get there if you don't have a ticket and see if there's space to walk in, which there was. But we had a blast.
Yes, we did. And like you said, the view was just absolutely phenomenal. And it was honestly pretty cool that they were able to find a place that really encompasses New York City, you know, like to have like the iconic Wimbledon spot in an iconic New York City spot. Very, very cool and smart on their part. And they had so many treats. We got to try strawberries and cream.
They were honestly kind of bad just because the strawberries were bad. Like
they were just fine. Like they were just New York City strawberries.
Fine. They were fine.
They weren't phenomenal. Yeah. Because I know at Wimbledon, they advertise, like, oh, they come fresh from the farms, 30 miles from here. Like, I need that. I need that. Yeah. But,
I went once a few years ago, and I remember them being, like, GMO level, like, red. Like, the amount, like, they like, literally looked as if it was almost artificial, which they obviously weren't. But having tasted that, definitely the ones at the Hill in New York weren't as good, but we had to get them.
They were
obviously
a staple. Yeah, you can't
you can't just go and not get them.
Oh, let me tell the club soda story. Okay, so we were thirsty, obviously, for something with some ice, and they had all these cocktail drinks, like nice, fancy alcoholic drinks from their sponsor, which I think was called Sipsmith. But we go online hoping that they have some mocktails because, you know, that's our whole brand. We are underage. So
they did almost give us the wristbands, though.
They did because they somehow checked IDs. Passed. Yeah.
They checked IDs at the entrance and the people started like,
there's some miscommunication.
Yeah, the guy who checked our IDs didn't tell the stewards that we were under 21. He was just like, just go through, like, just like pass the wristband, people just go through. But the people with the wristband started giving us the wristbands, and we were like, wait, what? The guy told us to go through, and it didn't click in our brains that that's what the wristbands were for. We were generally just like clueless. So, but either way, we were really hoping there would be something there,
yeah,
aside from the Sipsmith gin.
Yeah, so we asked the guy, we were like, so, do you guys have any sort of mocktails? And he was like, no, but I can offer you a club soda. And we're like, like, okay. And then that club soda was like $5, by the way, which is a little insane. But I kept the cup, so maybe it was worth it. But he goes, you know what? No, I said, yeah, I said, you know what? I'll take the club soda. I really want something with ice. And then he yells the the bartender, he's like, club soda, make it cute. Because, you know, he understood that we were on that aesthetic, like, Instagram exactly. mission.
Exactly.
You know, like, we dressed up, we were definitely the best dressed there.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
Oh, yeah.
So, and if you check out the Instagram and the Twitter, phenomenal content. Just amazing. There's even a pic of me there having some funny business with Andy Murray, you know? It's just all the tea, all the yes. good stuff.
Yeah, it was an awesome thing. I loved that it was for free, obviously not including the food and stuff that was there, but it was so nice to get to, you know, dress up, embrace the Wimbledon aesthetic. We definitely took some pointers from Morgan Riddle and the stuff that she was Shout posting out. For some outfit inspo and just general aesthetic inspo. And even though the strawberries and cream weren't even close to what the actual ones are, they definitely were an important part of the overall experience that we had, because that was definitely a fun day. And the match itself was also a very interesting one. Let's do a quick recap of the Women's Championship. In the semifinals, Ange Jabeur, the third seed, defeated Tatiana Maria in 3 sets. And Jabeur actually is leading right now the WTA Tour with the most 3-set wins this year at 13. But we just want to take a little bit of a moment to shout out Tatiana, because it's an awesome story from her. She's 34 years old, gave birth to her second daughter 15 months ago, and in the 34 Grand Slam main draw she's played, she has never made it past the third round, so she has never made it into the second week. She said, "I'm in the semifinal of Wimbledon and it's crazy, but I'm still a mom, and after this I will go out over there and see my kids and do the same thing I do every day. I will change Pampers, everything is normal. I try to keep things normal as much as possible. That's what makes me proudest, to be a mom." So I loved that, because it kind of shows that you can do it both.
And not even that, she takes her first daughter to tennis practice every morning at 8:30 a.m., which is crazy dedication, but, you know, after all those years of Shravi and I's parents taking us to tennis practice literally multiple times a week, I understand how it might get annoying, but she continues to persist, and obviously tennis runs well in the family.
And she was doing this while at Wimbledon, like taking her daughter every morning to practice, which I thought was pretty awesome. And I mean, hey, got her to the semis, so good for her.
Mm-hmm. And her husband said, "I believe in my wife. I tell her always that I know she's capable of doing bigger things. Tatiana's a warrior."
Fun fact also, Tatiana is really popular on tour. She and Ons are really close friends. Ons even said that she's her barbecue buddy. And I love Tatiana so much, and her family is really amazing. And Tatiana is also Venus and Serena's neighbor and friend in Florida. And the Williams sisters actually threw her a baby shower. So, look at that. I mean, this was, I think, one of the best stories of the tournament, seeing her succeed. We always have, like, that one player.
The Cinderella story.
Yeah, the Cinderella stories. And this is the one that I actually, sometimes I'm like, why is this random person so deep into the tournament when they beat my fate? But Tatiana, this was awesome to see. I thought it was a great run for her.
Yes. So as for the other semifinal, also quite exciting, Elena Rybakina, the 17th seed that eventually made it to the final and to the championship, I guess, defeated Simona Halep, a previous Wimbledon champion, the 2019 champion, and the 16th seed, so right below, 6-3, 6-3, so pretty one-sided match, but very exciting to see it all coming together for Rybakina. She only dropped one set en route to the final, and that was in her quarterfinal versus Tomljanović, and props to Tomljanović for making it to the quarterfinals again. Awesome.
Back to back.
Mm-hmm. So, and then we have Simona, of course. So she had a 12-match win streak at Wimbledon, as the 2019 champion, and since she didn't play last year. And this has been her best Grand Slam result in a while. Definitely not because of Patrick. I just think Simona and Wimbledon, you know, they have good what's the word I use?
Mojo.
Good, yeah, exactly. I was gonna say juju, but yeah.
Oh yeah, that works that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, Simona also, like, she's coming off of going out in round two of the French Open, so this was a great way to bounce back. And I think also, like, I was surprised by this, but could we be seeing her back, you know, in contention for more slams? I think this was really promising. You know, the U.S. Open is historically her worst slam. And I do wonder if she could maybe finally pull something there, because this was, like, as you said, like, a really, really impressive result from her.
Yeah. And honestly, just Simona on grass is amazing. It's, like, all I can remember, like, the most inspiring stat I've ever heard is that in her 2019 final against Serena Williams, she made 3 unforced errors.
Oh, yes!
Like, that is insane to me. And I that number never left my mind, the fact that a person could play that perfect of a match.
I make 3 unforced errors per game.
Yep.
So.
Yep, exactly. So, it is quite inspiring, and just for the whole match, like, I can't even imagine. But no. Still, it's just like, maybe it is possible to be able to play tennis.
All right, let's talk about the final now. So, Elena Rybakina, the 17th seed, defeated Ons Jabeur, 3rd seed, 3-6, 6-2, 6-2. A very abrupt momentum swing in that match, that was for sure. But Ons, I mean, she was on fire in the first set. She was playing really well, and, I mean, really didn't let Rybakina take control of points at all. But as soon as we got to the second set, she really lost her focus, and after that, it was really just Elena's time to shine. Ons was playing a bit sloppy, but even aside from that, Elena, you know, her weaknesses became her strength. Chris Evert was, like, continuously,
like,
talking about
this so much.
Like, she literally did not stop talking about it. She kept being, like, in the first set, like, Ons with her drop shot and bringing Elena into the net, like, that's the way to beat her, because Elena's not comfortable at the net. But Elena seemed fearless up there at the net, especially in those second two sets. I mean, she was hitting volley winners, she was moving in, she was not fazed by Ons' drop shots or variety. So really impressive growth from her. And something that we were, like, in awe of was that we didn't realize how tall she was.
Yeah, 6 feet, hello?
Yeah.
I did not know. I had no idea. Because also, like, her personality makes her seem that she's, like, a small person, you know? She doesn't give off tall energy. But,
yeah.
And then they were talking about Ons compared to her, that she's 5'6". Like, hello? That's pretty tall for a woman.
Yeah.
Just, it was really, like, since we were there watching this, it was really funny to just hear the commentators throughout the match. Like, we could do that. Maybe better. Yeah.
But, I mean, that height definitely benefited her because her serve was awesome throughout the match. She definitely got a head start in points with that. But, you know, I think that one thing that people were really sort of talking about with Elena throughout the tournament was her sort of composure and how she's very chill. And, in fact, some people think too chill. Mm-hmm. But honestly, because she does not really show her emotions that much. Like, a couple of fist pumps in a match is, like, a lot for her. And even after winning, I think it was probably, like, disbelief almost. But it seemed like she just won any other match. Because she didn't really make a big reaction. And, you know, I think I get why people are kind of, like, surprised and shocked about it. But, I mean, I think it's just everyone has different ways of sort of dealing with emotions. So, a lot of people on Twitter, like, after she won, spent more time sort of being like, oh my god, like, she's so weird, like, why didn't, like, she should be happier, like, blah blah blah. Like, of course she's happy, just because she doesn't, you know, show emotion in the way that you would expect, you know, her to, doesn't mean that, you know, she's
it was
not
funny though.
It was hilarious. It was so funny because she was like, literally, it just seemed like any other like routine win. But at the same time, it's like, let the girl live. She just won a Grand Slam. Good for her. It's
honestly,
kind of actually kind of cool that she's that chill about it.
Like, Medvedev just, like, walking. I really thought he was just going to walk to the net like nothing happened. And actually, he does do that. He did that when he won the ATP Tour final, whatever it's called, the finals, the ATP finals. So it's the same thing. Like, it's not that big a deal.
She didn't do it to be ironic, though.
She didn't do it to be ironic. That's just how she is.
That's just how she is.
Yeah. But then, like, her speech was really cute, and then she did show emotion eventually. But, but still. Yeah. It was cool.
Yeah. Definitely want to give a shout-out to Ons, though. A fantastic rest season. I think definitely people felt like this was Ons' tournament to win, and we obviously were going and rooting for her, too. It's hard to be mad when she loses against someone who was playing so well and who was definition, I guess, of, like, unproblematic fave, if Elena is one of your favorite players. But I really hope Ons doesn't get discouraged by this and she does get another chance to take a major title because she's certainly deserving. But just one more thing, I guess, to talk about Elena is a lot of people were fascinated by her nationality and kind of the history behind that. So she's the first Kazakh player to win a Grand Slam singles title. And, you know, what's interesting about her is that she was actually born in Russia. She still lives in Moscow. And she changed her nationality at 18 years old to be playing with the Kazakhstan flag because she didn't really feel that she was getting enough support by the Russian Tennis Federation. Whereas the Kazakh Tennis Federation was much more willing to support her. And a lot of this is not uncommon. We've seen other Russian-born players like Yulia Putintseva or Alexander Bublik doing that as well, because the Kazakh Tennis Federation showed much more interest and support for them than they were getting at home. And what's interesting is that the Kazakh Tennis Federation is run by a Kazakhstani billionaire named Bulat... Josephina, you pronounce this.
Yuta Muratov. I think. Yes. Maybe some wrong accents there, but I've got most of it. But he essentially works with the government to finance the growth of tennis in Kazakhstan in an effort to fit into Western conventions, which is interesting. And honestly, if I had a bunch of money, I would use it on tennis too. So...
he was actually sitting in her box as well from the semis onward.
Like, the way they spoke about it, it seemed like it was a huge honor that he was there to watch. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And she gave him a big hug also when she went over to the box, which was sweet. But what she said about playing for Kazakhstan, she said, "I'm playing for Kazakhstan a long time. I'm really happy representing Kazakhstan. They believed in me. There's no more question about how I feel. It's already a long time, my journey as a Kazakh player." So she is definitely thankful for the help and support and proud to represent Kazakhstan. Because, I mean, if that's where you get your resources and that's who supports you, then you should, as you should, just wherever you feel most appreciated.
Yeah, of course. I think it does, in a way, make the whole thing about the Wimbledon Russian tennis player ban a little bit more ironic because
she definitely...
Kate Middleton did end up giving the trophy to a Russian-born and bred player.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, there's plenty of athletes and players who choose nationality for their own reasons, whether that be support or how they feel their see their identity or whatever, and I think sometimes people sort of, nationality means thing, like, matters to people in different ways and to varying degrees. I think that Elena sort of did a really good job responding to a lot of these questions because this is what everyone was talking about and saying that, listen, like
she finessed
the
system.
They supported me. No. They supported me. They gave me that help and, you know, I'm thankful for that and I'm happy to represent them. As my country, because as she should, like, that was her choice, that was her career move, and it clearly paid off, because look at her now.
Yeah.
What is funny, though, is that the president of the Russian Tennis Federation, sort of after Rybakina won, claimed that she was sort of, like, claimed that, wow, like, a Russian won Wimbledon, like, how fantastic. And I was just like, okay, that's not quite the case, but yeah. Sure.
I find it interesting how, like, even in tennis, kind of like, you know how in soccer you have teams that represent countries, but you trade players from all over the world? I didn't realize that that could be a thing in tennis as well. Like, I always felt like it's just you're attached to your nationality. That's just how it is. But then you have to consider situations like this where people seek support from countries that are looking to support you more, or even like people that are biracial, for example. Like, for example, like Naomi Osaka has spoken about how it was a choice for her to represent Japan because she could have chosen Haiti, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's.
Or just the US, even.
Yeah, it's a different journey for everybody. So I just think it's really cool how that means, or nationality representation means different things to different people.
Yeah. I think it's also a good sign of agency. Like, you as a player, as an athlete, can choose that, and that's up to you. Because it obviously matters to people. And it's obviously, like, they're not going to choose a country that they don't feel comfortable or don't feel passionate about playing for. Well, passionate, whatever. But, like, you know, if she made that choice, and good for her that she's... She did actually... I was really actually happy with the way she was responding to these questions, because she was getting bombarded by the press about this. A lot of questions also about her stance on the ban and on the war. She kept her responses pretty, you know, pretty basic, obviously, understandably so. But honestly, the one time that she did burst into tears... finally, and when the emotions seemed to really show, were after she was asked in her press conference about what her parents' reaction would be to her winning, or was to her winning, and she immediately started crying and talked about how they'd be really proud. So
yeah,
it's hard to not be happy for her. I thought her speech definitely on court definitely won me over, because she was like rambling and mm-hmm. It was kind of cute, but definitely a deserving win.
Yeah, for sure. So now that we've covered the wonderful women's championship, let's talk about the men's side. Yeah.
Woo!
Party time. Okay, so Novak Djokovic and Nick Kyrgios, you already know the deal. But first, we're going to dive into some semi-recaps, because that's where the action starts. Unless it doesn't, in the case of a walkover, which we'll get to. But Novak Djokovic defeated Cameron Norrie 2-6, 6-3, 6-2, 6-4. And honestly, we even noticed this last year at the US Open. He just has this habit of starting slow and then getting into it. Like this 4-set pattern every single time. Like you give the other player hope and then just take him out. We saw this.
And they can't deal with it. Yeah.
Exactly. Last year at the US Open with Jensen Brooksby, probably a couple of other players, but still. So Cameron Norrie is actually the only the fourth British man in the open era to reach the last four at Wimbledon. And reaching the last four was a lot for him, because he had just defeated Gauffin in the quarterfinal in 5 sets, 3 hours and 28 minutes. But props to David Gauffin for getting this far again. I feel like we haven't seen him in so long.
Yeah, definitely. I thought that was a nice little run from him. But, you know, obviously the British crowd was really on Cam's side in this one. Djokovic was on the receiving end of some booing towards the end of the match. But on the other side, we were slated to have Kyrgios versus Rafael Nadal, but Nadal had to withdraw. And, you know, we were close to another Rafa-Novak final, but, you know, unfortunately this withdrawal put Nick Kyrgios into a Grand Slam final and a Wimbledon final at that. But what happened was this sort of injury came up in his match against Taylor Fritz in the quarters, but he had to withdraw due to a 7-millimeter abdominal tear that had been bothering him. He said he'd been feeling pain all week and had worsened in that 5-set match against Taylor Fritz, which was really awesome tennis from Fritz, by the way. But, and honestly, it was Fritz's match to win. He really should have won that match, because Nadal was not serving well at all.
Couldn't
definitely
serve.
Definitely not physically fit. Yeah, he couldn't serve. his Nadal's family was signaling to Nadal saying that he should retire because they could tell how much pain he was in.
Oh, and I can't even imagine like what that must be like watching.
Yeah, this is just like a recurring thing we've been talking about, especially this year with him, about the fact that you need to know when to stop. And I think this time he finally realized that even though he felt like he was playing good tennis and certainly had a shot at a calendar Grand Slam this year, it was time to withdraw. Some people were saying that this means that they should use the lucky loser rule and put Taylor Fritz back into the semis versus Kyrgios. And I was like, that is so stupid. That is, like, the most stupid take I think I've ever heard in tennis. Like, Fritz, great tournament, played well.
But he lost the match.
He lost the match, and a match that he really should have won. And he knows that. Yeah, but even Taylor was like, even Taylor was like, listen, like, this was, like, on me for not being able to beat him when I was in a, you know, leading position, but so it really doesn't make sense. Like, this, like, there's no way that I should be put back into the draw.
Like, I understand the sentiment of, like, who's letting Kyrgios through to a final without, like, any effort, but also it's just, like, that's just not how things are done, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Like, why would you make an exception?
He lost fair and square, so.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. So, he was in pain throughout that match. He was leaning on walls to stabilize himself, even took a medical timeout, and then people were talking about how he was faking injury, which I did not understand the grounds of that at all, but I saw it everywhere on posts about him withdrawing. Like, oh, he's just faking injury. I don't know why.
Why would he withdraw, though, if he was faking it?
No, they were saying, like, I guess he's not faking injury because he actually withdrew.
Oh.
Because they were like,
I see.
How could he make it through the five-setter if he looks like he's in that much pain? Like, obviously, it's not real.
TBH, I don't know how he made it through the five-setter.
He's just built from something other earthly.
Yes, but at what cost, though?
Yeah, that's what, like, I'm saying. Like,
at what cost is all this for?
Because you build up the idea of, like, you know, big achievements in tennis, like the calendar slam, a grand slam, all these big things, but at a certain point, like, you're just a human being that has to take, like, protect your body. It's just the most primal instinct.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it's fallen to the side, and it's like, I'll do anything, like, I'll hurt my body to get here. But it's just, that's not how it should work.
I saw a lot of stuff also about people saying that he's chickening out to play against Nate Kyrgios, and I'm like, Rafael Nadal is, like, loves to compete, and, you know, there is no way this was out of
This was probably not his decision, too.
Yeah. He said, I made my decision because I believe that I can't win two matches under these circumstances. I have to say that, imagine myself winning two matches, and for respect to myself in some way, I don't want to go out there, not be competitive enough to play at the level that I need to play to achieve my goal, and with a big chance to make the things much worse. That's really the key thing here, knowing that going further would make things a lot worse, and, you know, take him out of contention for a fit season otherwise. Now, Kyrgios, he got to the semis after defeating Christian Garin in three sets. Don't know what Christian Garin is doing in a Grand Slam quarterfinal, but I guess good for him.
Like, we're fans, but what?
Yeah, for sure. But just to briefly talk about this final, Djokovic defeated Kyrgios in four sets, lost the first 4-6, then went on 6-3, 6-4, 7-6. Novak had a losing record against Nick. He never even won a set against him, which was, like, bizarre. But I was talking to my friend last night. He's a huge Novak fan, and he was, like, stressed. I was like, you know what? Novak Djokovic in a Grand Slam final, like, I don't see him losing at all to Nick Kyrgios. I think this is the time that it's gonna come. But fourth consecutive Wimbledon title, seventh overall, 21st Grand Slam. So we got Fed at 20, Novak 21, Rafa 22. It does not seem like he will be able to play the U.S. Open because he's still unvaccinated unless the U.S. changes rules. But at the moment, this seems like this is probably his last Grand Slam of the year. But just the weirdest part about this whole thing over the past couple of days is this bizarre bromance that has come out of Djokovic and Kyrgios. Starting with some really interesting Instagram exchanges.
Yeah, so this basically started like a day before the final. We saw this on Instagram where Kyrgios reposted a post about like a friendly conversation that they once had, like agreeing on something. Like they were just posting some quotes, and then he tagged Novak in that and then asked, "We friends now?" And then Novak reposted that story and wrote, responding to the "We friends now" from Kyrgios, "If you are inviting me for a drink or dinner, I accept," and then like some emojis, and then he said, "PS, winner of tomorrow pays." It's like wholesome, but not the time.
Not the time. Like, you really like you. What an interesting, you know, way to act with a guy who not only is so disgusting in terms of his behavior on court, but who just got, you know, called to court.
Yeah, I expected assault, like Djokovic, to be above this, but he's always like getting down in the dirt. Like, it's like he strives to be controversial.
We saw what he posted after the Zverev stuff as well, and like said some things about how he feels bad about what he's going.
Yeah, through. I know. It's
It's quite the takes.
And
it's quite a take.
Yeah, and then Novak even said later, I don't know if I think this is after the final, but he said about Nick, "It's officially a romance." What?
Cringe. This is like the definition of like this is the stuff that people will be talking about. This is, like, how Nick really just, like, comes into light as, like, that bro-y, like, guy who's, like, you know, popular in the locker room. Like, people like him. Like, he's good for the sport.
Yeah.
Just douchebag, but the douchebag that attracts even douchier fans to tennis.
Yep. And then, which is very ironic. Very ironic on the part that Novak is, like, kind of just not really caring about assault cases. It was his and Helena's wedding anniversary.
Helena.
Is it not Helena? I'm sorry.
It's Yelena.
Okay, sorry. I read the J as a H. That's my bad.
Oh, yeah.
But it was their wedding anniversary today, and some people were saying, like, how could he mention Nick's in his bromance in his speech and not even mention that? So that was kind of...
Wait, he didn't even mention...
Not in his speech, his trophy ceremony, no.
That's so awkward.
Exactly. But on a final note, what are our thoughts on that new airplane celebration? What is that?
I think he's just milking his on-court experiences because he knows that he's not really gonna have many opponents to play this year. So he's kind of just like, hey, Daniil came up with a cool thing. That was a heartbreaking loss. May as well come up with my own thing.
No, because people think it's funny and cool, but like, you know how much effort it takes to put yourself down on the ground and do all that? It's too much. Like, you're supposed to do something that
we're just
seems
hating
in
now.
The moment. Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Just hating now.
And, like, yeah. In my opinion, it reminds me too much of soccer. Like, that's a stupid thing a soccer player would do. Let's be honest.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, the men's tournament really didn't attract me at all, just with all the Kyrgios stuff.
But what's his name?
Obviously, if Berrettini didn't get COVID, I don't think we'd be seeing Nick Kyrgios in a Grand Slam final.
Oh,
because they were in the same section of the draw. It should have been a Berrettini-Nadal semi, is what, you know, was predicted, obviously, because Berrettini was having an amazing grass season.
He was undefeated.
And then if Nadal had pulled out, we would see Berrettini make a back-to-back Wimbledon final. But instead, because of COVID, we have Nick Kyrgios there. What's interesting is that, obviously, with the no points thing, Novak Djokovic will actually drop in the rankings because he will be losing all his points from last year, which is kind of messed up,
it's
if you think about
really
it.
Really dumb. Yeah. Like, they should have made it protected for this. Because, like,
I don't even know.
Yeah, they don't realize that, like, the idea was there, but you have to kind of follow through all the way or else you're still ending up hurting players.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. But that's Wimbledon for you.
That's that for that.
We made it. I was not expecting any of this at all, I don't think. But we definitely had some good stories here. But definitely also some things that we need to continue to be talking about, because clearly some people won't talk about it enough.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us, and that is Game, Set, and Match for today.
If you like this episode, please let us know and stay tuned for more. We'll be providing you all the coverage of upcoming tennis and, of course, all the tea on tour.
Email us at holdontoyourracket@gmail.com for any questions, and leave a rating on whatever platform you're listening on.
Hold On To Your Racket is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts.
Follow us on social media at holdontoyourracket on Instagram and at @HOTYR_tennispod on Twitter. Our next episode up will be released as tennis moves to the United States and we get started on the US Open Tour.
And remember, my name is Josefina.
And my name is Shravya.
And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to hold on to your racket until next time.